KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Protests against deportations continue in L.A. as President Trump readies more National Guard and the Marines. We hear from the top Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee for his take on the president's actions. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Leila Fadel shares more about her reporting on Hungary's prime minister who took control of university funding and restricted international students. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. How did American conservatives get so excited about his policies? Also, how the fighting in Russia and Ukraine evolved from World War I-style trench battles to war dominated by drones on both sides. It's Tuesday, June 10th. On this day in 1963, President Kennedy signed the Equal Pay Act, forbidding employers from wage discrimination based on gender. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Protests dwindled overnight in Los Angeles as demonstrators continue to protest federal immigration raids. Steve Futterman has more.
The number of protesters who refused police orders to disperse was not enormous. Several hundred when the confrontations began in the early evening. By midnight, it was down to a few dozen. New raids by ICE agents is fueling the anger. L.A. Mayor Karen Bass.
I can't emphasize enough the level of fear and terror that is in Angelenos right now, not knowing if tomorrow or tonight it might be where they live, it might be their workplace.
Local officials here have been frustrated by the continuing nightly confrontations and are discussing the possibility of a limited curfew. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
President Trump has ordered thousands of National Guard troops and at least 700 U.S. Marines to the Los Angeles area. Writing online this morning, Trump said that if he didn't do this, L.A., quote, would be burning to the ground right now. California's governor and attorney general disagree. California Attorney General Rob Bonta says they have sued Trump because the president used faulty reasoning under federal law to send in federal troops.
He's violating 10 U.S.C. 12406, which is the statute that he relies on, that he says gives him authority to call in the National Guard to Los Angeles. A clear, unambiguous language of the statute says there needs to be a rebellion or an invasion or a situation in which the president is unable with the regular forces to execute the laws of the United States. None of those things are present.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. A federal judge is temporarily blocking President Trump's cost-cutting entity, DOGE, from accessing personnel records. As NPR Shannon Bond reports, it's the latest ruling to restrict DOGE's ability to view sensitive data.
The court ruled the Federal Office of Personnel Management broke privacy law and its own cybersecurity practices when it allowed DOGE staffers to access the files of millions of current and former federal workers. The scope of the injunction is still being determined by the court. But Judge Denise Cote ordered DOGE staff to destroy all copies of personal information related to the union members who brought the lawsuit. The case will likely head to the Supreme Court, which has recently reversed other lower court rulings curtailing DOGE. Last week, the High Court granted DOGE access to sensitive data held by the Social Security Administration. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
U.S. and Chinese officials are continuing their latest round of trade talks today in London. The U.S. is seeking China's rare earth minerals that are used in electric vehicles. China wants the U.S. to loosen its restrictions on sales of American goods. These include software to make computer chips. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. There are reports of problems among jurors who are deliberating the sexual assault retrial in New York of former movie producer Harvey Weinstein. The jury foreperson held a meeting with the trial judge. A transcript made available to the Associated Press says the foreperson told the trial judge that other jurors were going beyond the charges as they deliberated. The foreperson also said parts of Weinstein's past have come up, although that is not the focus of the jury's efforts. The trial judge has rejected a call by Weinstein's lawyers for a mistrial. The Southern Baptist Convention begins its annual meeting today in Dallas. More than 10,000 Southern Baptist leaders will consider policy changes for the largest Protestant denomination in the U.S. Bob Smetana of Religion News Service has more.
The delegates, known as messengers, will likely debate a proposal to ban churches with women pastors from the 12.7 million member denomination. A similar proposal failed last year. Delegates will also deal with legal bills from a sex abuse crisis and decide the fate of their public policy arm, which has clashed with Trump supporters. The meeting begins Tuesday and will end on Wednesday. For NPR News, I'm Bob Smetana.
This story is from a collaboration between NPR and Religion News Service. British spy novelist Frederick Forsyth has died at the age of 86, according to his publisher. Forsyth's most popular works include Day of the Jackal, The Odessa File, and The Dogs of War. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. For the fourth straight night, people in Los Angeles took to the streets to protest ICE immigration raids.
President Trump is now sending hundreds of active duty Marines into the city and an additional 2,000 National Guard troops, doubling the amount he mobilized over the weekend. Trump says it's to control the protests. California's governor and LA's mayor, both Democrats, are calling this an unnecessary escalation.
NPR's Adrian Florido is in Los Angeles and is with us now to tell us more about all this. Good morning, Adrian.
Good morning, Michelle.
So what's the latest on these Marines heading into the city?
Well, the Defense Department said it's bringing 700 active duty Marines in from 29 Palms, a military base 150 miles east of L.A. A defense official told NPR they will be working with the already deployed National Guard troops. So this is a combined 4,700 military troops being deployed to Los Angeles for what so far have been largely peaceful protests with flare-ups of violence and vandalism.
What do we know about what these Marines will be allowed to do?
Well, for now, the Pentagon says that they will be working with the National Guard troops to protect federal buildings and federal agents carrying out immigration enforcement. It's uncertain how much more they can do. Federal law generally bars active duty forces from domestic law enforcement unless the president invokes the Insurrection Act. Trump has not done that yet, but has suggested that he could. He's already called these protesters insurrectionists.
So what's been the response of California's governor, Gavin Newsom, who is, as we said, a Democrat?
Well, he's been saying since the weekend that the president is trying to sow chaos. He calls this escalation unneeded and provocative. He said local and state police have been able to handle protesters who have turned violent, and that they've been working to keep the peace on the streets. But here's what Newsom said to Fox's LA affiliate KTTV.
That's not what Trump is after. He's not for peacemaking. He's here for war. He wants a civil war on the streets.
Newsom filed suit challenging Trump's decision to take over the state National Guard without his authorization and has said that he'll also sue over the deployment of the Marines. For his part, Michelle, Trump yesterday endorsed the idea of arresting Gavin Newsom, which is an extraordinary thing to say about a sitting governor.
And so you've been talking to a lot of people who've been participating in these protests. What are they saying about these thousands of troops being sent into the city?
A lot of them are saying they fear that these troops coming in will inflame tension on the streets even further, like Sandra Martinez. She was out peacefully protesting last night.
They're going to make it worse. Look at what everybody's doing. People are just going to riled up.
LA Mayor Karen Bass, Michelle, said that the Trump administration is trying to see how far it can go to take control away from cities and states.
I don't think that our city should be used for an experiment to see what happens in the nation's second largest city. Well, maybe we can do this to other cities.
She called on ICE to end its raids in Los Angeles. She said it conducted at least five yesterday.
Adrian, before we let you go, I understand that these protests against ICE raids are now spreading to other cities.
They are. There were protests in at least two dozen cities across the country yesterday, and officials in different places are starting to express concern that things could get out of hand if the Trump administration continues down this path. Last night, Senator Jack Reed, the top Democrat on the Armed Services Committee, said the president is using the military as a political weapon, which Reed said could, quote, turn a tense situation in L.A. into a national crisis.
That is NPR's Adrian Florido in Los Angeles. Adrian, thank you so much.
Thank you, Michelle.
We've been getting reaction to these events from a range of voices. Now we're going to hear from Congressman Adam Smith of Washington State. He is the top Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee. Good morning, Congressman. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
So given your role in armed services, and you're also a lawyer by training, do you believe the president is acting legally in calling up active duty military?
I do not. The statute that he is using technically gives him the authority to use troops in this manner, but only in the case that there's the risk of a rebellion. And that is certainly not the case here. So as he has done in a number of areas, he's taking emergency authority that was meant for very narrow, specific circumstances, and just broadening it beyond all recognition. I think the courts would strike down this authority if the court case got there. But President Trump's not particularly interested in following the law. I agree with Senator Reid. I agree with Governor Newsom. President Trump wants this confrontation, partially because he wants to emphasize the issue of immigration enforcement, but more, I fear, because he wants to politicize the U.S. military and legitimize using it as a law enforcement tool, which is incredibly dangerous.
So you're from Washington State, not California, but you've said it was clear to you that the LAPD had the situation under control. The White House says it observed what it called, quote, violent rioters, unquote, that were being enabled by California's governor. Why do you think you're looking at the same thing but coming to such different conclusions?
Yeah, I forget exactly what I said in my statement. What I say, the situation was not out of control. It was not to the point where there was, you know, widespread violence. The local law enforcement clearly had the ability to handle what was in front of them, and that's not even really debatable. So why did the president choose to bring in troops in a situation where it was not necessary? And I think that gets to the larger effort here of President Trump wanting to use the military as sort of his personal police force, and he wants to legitimize those actions. Look, I don't think there have been protests in a variety of different places on a variety of different issues. I mean, this was incredibly minor compared to a lot of different protests that have gone on at different places. And yet the president chose to escalate in this way. And you're seeing people respond. The president has created an incredibly dangerous situation with the risk of even further escalation.
So I can imagine that it is somewhat galling to someone like yourself, who was trapped on Capitol Hill during the January 6th mob attack on the Capitol, when the President Trump, took many hours to condemn the violence or call for reinforcements for the law enforcement officers who were trying to hold the Capitol and protect people like yourself then. But having said that, Democratic Senator John Fetterman on his X account described the scenes in L.A. as, quote, anarchy and true chaos. And he said that Democrats lose the moral high ground when members refuse to condemn the violence from protesters. What do you say to that?
Two quick points on that. First of all, absolutely. I mean, we had an actual insurrection on January 6th here at the Capitol. People were actually trying to stop the election of a president. They were threatening to kill elected officials, including Vice President Pence. That was an actual insurrection that the president chose to ignore. And to this day, he has pardoned all of the people involved and downplayed that event. So that is completely unacceptable. Second, what was going on in Los Angeles, there was a protest. The protest was fine. The violence that erupted out of it was not fine. But again, local law enforcement could have handled that. Now, I think Senator Fetterman has a point. You know, we should condemn protests when they violate the law. If you're setting things on fire, if you're damaging property, you can do that. But you can say what Senator Fetterman said about that stuff getting out of control and still recognize that the president's reaction using the U.S. military for domestic law enforcement, both things can be true. It can be true that protesters should not damage property, threaten people, and it can also be true that the president calling in the U.S. military for something like this, given his history and what he has said, threatening to arrest the governor of California, it is clear the president is attempting to use the military and to exercise a level of control over this country that our Constitution has clearly said no president should do. We should be worried about the authoritarian approach President Trump has taken.
So if you have a couple more minutes for me, are you hearing concerns from other than Democrats at this point? Are any of your Republican colleagues concerned about the president's use of active duty military to address a domestic situation?
Well, if they are, they're keeping it to themselves, as they often have. I mean, they've let President Trump get away with absolutely everything. Things they said they completely opposed, didn't support. Trump does it. They don't say a thing. The Republicans in Congress need to start standing up for law and the Constitution and stop simply bowing to whatever Donald Trump says he wants to do.
But if this is, in fact, a concern of governance, of appropriate governments, and, in fact, in your opinion, represents sort of another constitutional question, as it were, wouldn't you think that some Republicans would be concerned about that? They have institutional authority as well that they would be interested in defending. You don't think?
I would think they would be concerned about that. But again, you've seen the pattern in a whole series of issues. I mean, we've had Republicans who have been passionate advocates for foreign aid stand by where the president completely shut down the entire program. You know, we've had, you know, Republicans who have consistently supported scientific research, stand by why the president guts all of the scientific research. We've certainly had Republicans who believe in the power of Congress to appropriate funds stand by while the president simply unilaterally decides not to spend money that Congress has lawfully told him to spend. So how far Republicans are willing to simply ignore their own principles because of the fear they have for President Trump politically, I don't think we've plumbed those depths just yet. But let's get back to the central issue here. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, Senator Fetterman's right. We should not passively allow people to riot and set things on fire and damage property. But that is entirely different than the President of the United States calling in the U.S. military, in this case, the active duty U.S. military, not even the Guard, to, you know, enforce something that was a relatively small protest when it started. President Trump is escalating this, I think, to enhance his own power, and we should be concerned about that.
So what should happen now, in your opinion? We have about 30 seconds.
Yeah, what should happen now is the courts should rule that the president is again abusing his emergency power. This is not an emergency as defined in the statute. You cannot simply say, you know, well, in case of an emergency, and then allow the president to define the emergency any way he wants to. The court should strike down his authority to bring in those troops. The president should de-escalate, and the protesters should de-escalate as well.
That is Congressman Adam Smith of Washington State. He's a Democrat and the ranking member on the House Armed Services Committee. Congressman Smith, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, MSNBC political analyst Molly John Fast on her new memoir and the issues she faced as the daughter of the famous novelist Erica Jong. It's also about the worst year in her life, 2023, when her husband was diagnosed with metastasized pancreatic cancer, and she put her mother and stepfather in a nursing home because of dementia. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We have some perspective on what the Trump administration really intends for independent parts of American society. When the administration struck at Harvard University, it officially was responding to anti-Semitism and diversity policies. Last month on this program, we asked Harvard President Alan Garber why else he thinks his university is a target.
I don't know fully what the motivations are, but I do know that there are people who are fighting a cultural battle.
Some conservatives do have a plan for universities and the media, which they talked up long before the Trump administration acted. They say they are inspired by the example of Hungary, where Prime Minister Viktor Orban has held power for 15 years. Leila Fallah was just there and is just back. Welcome home.
Thank you.
So let's start with the universities. What did Hungary's government under Orban do?
Well, basically, when Prime Minister Viktor Orban came to power, all of the universities, for the most part, were state-funded, but academically independent.
Right.
And so what happened was Orban privatized the universities, private foundations, funneled state and EU funds into these private foundations, and created board of trustees that were filled with loyalists to him and his party to tell the universities what to do. So for me, the top line is the money. The money is needed for these institutions to flourish, and Orban used the money to then control the universities. I spoke to Balint Magyar, who's a former education minister and a senior research fellow at the Democracy Institute at the Central European University, which was a prominent university in Hungary, and they had to move their campus to Vienna.
As most of the students came from non-EU countries, they needed special permissions to come to Hungary, visas. And I think this was the major blackmailing capacity of the government, which forced the university to move to Vienna.
I'm noticing, Leila, you're saying that the government got control of the streams of money to universities and also seemed to have acted against international students. Did this work, though? Does the government control universities?
For the most part, yes. Now universities, professors, academics, experts, the ones that remained independent or wanted to remain independent left and went to other parts of Europe. Again, it's part of the European Union, so easier to travel within the Union.
And then what did the government do over the last 15 years to independent journalism?
So there what Orban did, again, it was about funding and defunding. So the state television, which is state-funded but independent, fired the majority of people in there, repacked it with people who would be willing to run the government line. I mean, we actually spoke to a journalist who worked at state TV and ultimately left because she didn't want to be part of what she called dividing the people. Her name was Christina Balog, and she talked about one assignment she got.
The editor asked me, okay, make a report about and ask a doctor who says that this illness is coming back with the refugees.
Diseases?
Yes.
And what were you thinking when she asked you that?
It's not me. I don't want this, but I needed to do this because it was my work and I got the salary from this. So that's why I did it. But I felt bad.
This is a classic thing you're not supposed to do in journalism.
Right.
Rather than looking for answers, go looking for the answer that you're supposed
to find. And this followed the government line. I mean, Orban had these anti-immigration policies. He was feeding a steady diet through the media of really demonizing language around immigrants. And beyond just the state press, he was also calling on allies and friends to buy or found other press institutions and create this sort of right-wing media conglomerate. Much of the money, advertising in Hungary, comes from the state. And so they starved independent and opposition press of any financial oxygen.
So now I want to know how it would be that American conservatives would get so excited about this political activity in a landlocked Central European country of about 9.5 million people.
I mean, whatever you think of Orban, his critics and his detractors say that actually Orban put Hungary on the map and in the consciousness of American conservatives. We spoke to Boris Kalnoki, who's a prominent German journalist of Hungarian descent and the head of the School of Journalism at the state-funded educational institute Matthias Convenus Collegium, or MCC, and he describes it this way.
The reach out came from Hungary to thinkers, speakers, politicians in the Anglo-Saxon world, but then worldwide. And we had Americans coming over to study how Orban dealt with what they call the deep state. How can you not only win an election, but after that actually be in power and implement your program for which you have a mandate from your voters?
So as Orban becomes kind of a pariah in the European Union, they're withholding funds over anti-democratic practices, breaches of EU law. U.S. conservatives see Orban as an example to follow because not only was he elected, he was able to kind of erode the checks and balances so that he could get his policies in place.
This reach out, as he calls it, seems to have worked, given that you were there, Leila, at the same time as the Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, which is an annual American institution that now has a version of itself in Hungary.
Right. Fourth year in a row, the first ever a CPAC in Europe was in Hungary. That's expanded since. It was in Poland this year. And Matchlap is the chairman of CPAC. Here's what he had to say about Orban.
One of the reasons why he has a strong bond with President Trump is he had power, and then he lost power, and then he found a way to regain power. They understand that to be successful in the current environment in this country and in America and a lot of other important countries, do you accommodate the globalists or do you fight the globalists?
Leila, I listened to your reporting. I heard Hungarians who favor Orban saying, wait a minute, we're not anti-democratic. We're for democracy. We're the people who won the elections. What's the case against that?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, a lot of people said the only thing that's keeping Orban in power is that people keep voting for him. But his critics say, yes, Hungary has the trappings of democracy. You go, you vote, you pick a leader. But because a healthy democracy needs to have an independent judiciary, needs to have an independent media, needs to have a civil society that is independent of the government, they say their democracy is decaying around them. And this echo chamber is happening in which they dominate the media landscape. And so any checks or accountability at journalism or research is then stifled. And the latest issue is a new law that's coming through that they say is based on a Russian law, a foreign agent law, which basically would blacklist any organization taking funding from outside of Hungary. Hungary starving a lot of these organizations from state funding. These people turn abroad.
Leila, thanks for your great reporting. It's good to see you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
As climate change drives rising sea levels, millions of Americans are finding themselves in potential flood zones. In some places, elevating homes can reduce the risks.
Home elevation, I think, is one of those techniques that you're going to see used more and more as our nation faces increasing losses from flooding.
We'll take you to one New Jersey town where residents are building up. That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump is authorizing another 2,000 National Guard troops from California to be deployed in Los Angeles to help police quell protests in the city's downtown. That doubles his initial deployment. The president is also sending in 700 U.S. Marines. 4 days of protests have resulted in dozens of arrests. The demonstrations began after federal immigration agents started conducting raids targeting those in the U.S. without legal status. California's governor and the state's attorney general are suing. Megan Jamerson with member station KCRW says thousands of union members gathered in L.A. yesterday to show their support to the protesters.
Union members, including janitors, roofers, and flight attendants, joined in solidarity to call for an end to the terror they say ICE raids are causing in local immigrant communities. As co-president of Unite Here Local 11, Ada Briseño represents more than 30,000 hotel and service workers, many of whom are immigrants. She wants ICE out of L.A. now.
We don't want them here in Southern California, and we're going to make sure that our presence is felt, that we lift our voices in every which way we can, as long as it's peaceful.
Local unions for months now have been training workers and employers on their rights if ICE shows up at their workplace. For NPR News, I'm Megan Jamerson in Los Angeles.
This is NPR News. Austria's chancellor says today's deadly shooting at a secondary school in Graz has shaken his country. At least 9 people were killed when a gunman opened fire at the school. A number of others were injured in that attack. Police say the gunman is also dead, and they believe he acted alone. Death row inmates in Florida and Alabama are scheduled to be executed tonight. In Alabama, Gregory Hunt is to be put to death for sexually assaulting and killing a woman in 1988, as Kat Stromquist with the Gulf States Newsroom explains.
Alabama has executed 2 people so far this year. Gregory Hunt says because of his spirituality, he isn't afraid to die. He would be the 5th person in Alabama to be put to death by nitrogen gas. Hunt previously joined a legal challenge about lethal injection.
It seems like no matter what method they come up with, it has to involve some kind of cruelty.
A spokesperson for Alabama's attorney general says their office is in touch with the victim's family and that they're hopeful that she can finally receive justice. For NPR News, I'm Kat Stromquist in Atmore, Alabama.
Convicted killer Anthony Wainwright is to be executed in Florida. A second day of trade talks between the U.S. and China is underway in London, led by Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent. Stocks are mixed in early trading on Wall Street. The Dow is down 9 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Ukraine's attack this month that destroyed Russian warplanes is just one in a series of unprecedented drone strikes. Now, Russia has stocked up its own arsenal of drones and carried out the heaviest bombardment of the war just a few days ago. For a closer look at this escalation, let's bring in NPR's national security correspondent Greg Myrie. So, Greg, there's been a lot of reporting on Ukraine's surprise attack on Russian air bases, but we've heard a lot less about Russian strikes. What are they doing?
Well, Russia carried out another massive drone strike overnight. Kyiv was the main target. President Volodymyr Zelensky called it one of the heaviest attacks yet on the capital. And the night before, Russia carried out nearly 500 drone strikes nationwide. This past week has seen several Russian nighttime attacks in this range. 300, 400, 500 drones, the most extensive to date. Now, Ukraine shoots down or electronically jams most of these incoming Russian drones, but maybe 10% get through and they can inflict extensive damage.
Wow. So how the Russians developed all this firepower?
Yeah, the Russians had a very limited drone arsenal when they launched their full-scale invasion 3 years ago. But they soon realized that drones were going to play a major role and they needed a quick solution. So they started buying Iranian drones, but they're not that good and Iran wasn't making nearly enough of them. So Russia paid Iran for the technology and began making a Russian version known as the Garan. Now, I spoke with Omar Al-Ghuzbi at the Center for Advanced Defense Studies in Washington, a research institute. He's just written a report on the Russian program.
The most groundbreaking, revolutionary thing about the Garan model of drones is their mass production capability, as well as the capability of striking targets at a long range.
Do Russia and Ukraine use their drones in similar ways on the battlefield?
No, their approaches differ. Russia relies on sheer volume. They try to overwhelm Ukraine's air defenses by firing so many drones at so many places. And often the drones are really kind of a diversion. They want to occupy Ukraine's air defensive so that faster, more powerful Russian missiles can slip through.
Okay, what about Ukraine?
Well, Ukraine relies more on stealthy attacks that can come from land or air or sea. You know, with small, inexpensive drones, Ukraine just keeps constant pressure on Russian ground forces. It's increasingly difficult for these Russian troops to gather in large numbers for an operation because Ukraine's drones are virtually certain to spot them and attack. Ukraine has also pioneered drones at sea. They've been so lethal the past couple years. Russian warships don't dare venture anywhere near Ukraine's Black Sea coast. And just a month ago, a Ukrainian drone in the Black Sea shot down a Russian warplane, something that's never been done before.
Greg, I'm wondering if it's fair to say at this point that this is the first war where drones have played such a big role.
Yes, that's absolutely true, and more so by the day. At the start of the war, artillery caused most deaths and injuries, and much of the fighting looked like World War I trench warfare. But now, Ukraine says 70% of casualties on both sides are inflicted by drones. In just a few short years, drones have gone from expensive, high-end technology with a few specialized uses to cheap, disposable, mass-produced weapons that are absolutely everywhere on the battlefield.
All right, that's NPR's Greg Myrie. Greg, thanks.
Sure thing, eh?
President Trump has expanded one of the most controversial policies of his first term. It's a ban on travelers from certain countries. The order, which went into effect yesterday, restricts travel to the United States by citizens of 19 nations, many of them African and majority Muslim countries. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez has a closer look.
Well, we start by saying, hello, Iowa. This is
on the campaign trail, Donald Trump repeatedly boasted that he would bring back some of his toughest immigration policies, including the travel ban.
I will ship massive portions of federal law enforcement to immigration enforcement, and we will immediately restore and expand the Trump travel ban on entry from terror-plagued countries. We don't want
As the election grew closer, Trump expanded on his broader goals. It was not just about the border or national security. It was about protecting what he called the fabric of the country, as he explained in North Carolina.
They're destroying our country, and we can't take it any longer. We have to change. We have to change immediately. I think it's the biggest problem. I think it's bigger than the economy. I think it's bigger than inflation, because they're ruining the fabric of our country.
Upon entering the White House, Trump declared an invasion on the southern border, sought to end birthright citizenship, and suspended the refugee program. And then last week, he announced the new travel ban on citizens from 12 nations, including Afghanistan, Chad, and Libya. Seven other countries, including Sierra Leone and Venezuela, are under a partial ban.
We want to get them out now. We don't want to have other bad people coming into our country.
The measure is the latest example of how Trump is moving more aggressively to reshape the criteria for who is allowed in the country.
This isn't happening in a vacuum. It is part of a much broader agenda.
Krish Amara Vignaraja is president of Global Refuge, a resettlement agency. She says it's telling that the only refugees Trump is allowing into the country are white South Africans. People from other backgrounds are facing more restrictions.
On the one hand, we're seeing Afrikaners receive a chartered flight to enter the U.S., while the administration has moved swiftly and systematically to close legal avenues across the immigration system.
David Beer, the director of immigration studies at the Cato Institute, sees no consistent criteria for grouping these particular 19 countries together. He points to the emphasis in the new ban on people who overstay their visas. But there are more people from other countries who are doing that same thing, and they're not on the list.
There are more people who are overstaying from Europe than all of these African countries that have been banned by this put together.
The White House says it's not just about overstays. The banned nations also lack proper vetting, fail to share threat information, or won't accept back their deported citizens. Abigail Jackson, a White House spokeswoman, called the measures, quote, common sense restrictions that protect American citizens from dangerous foreign actors. Leon Fresco, who served on Trump's Homeland Security Advisory Council during his first term, says the new ban was carefully written to avoid the legal challenges of the original ban.
It will be very hard for a court to overturn this because this doesn't seem to be the kind of willy-nilly ban that doesn't take into account very important factors.
But others say it's less of a legal question and more of a moral one. John Simon, who served as the U.S. ambassador to the African Union in the Bush administration, says most of these African nations on the list are in dire straits.
The list looks less like an attempt to keep terrorists out and more like an attempt to keep people fleeing for their lives out.
He says that's at odds with what the U.S. has traditionally done, which is help those in need. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, The White House.
This is NPR News.
In the new TV series Murderbot, Alexander Skarsgård plays an AI robot that's antisocial and a little insecure. A break from his usual macho roles. Next time, here and now.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, May Martinez. Paleontologists have always thought long-necked dinosaurs ate plants. You know, like the big old Brachiosaurus in Jurassic Park. Their teeth are flat, not good for tearing chunks of flesh, and they're pretty slow, so no chasing potential meaty meals. But no hard proof until recently, when scientists found fossilized plants inside one of these dinosaurs' bellies, making them the biggest vegan of all time? Sounds right to me. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. It's a small device, but the hype around it is huge. The technology is called constant glucose monitoring, and companies that make it say it'll transform the way you feel. But what do scientific studies say? Michaeline Duclef finds out.
The monitor is about the size of a quarter, and it sticks to the back of your arm. Every few minutes or so, it sends a signal to your phone estimating the concentration of sugar in your blood. Elizabeth Selvin at Johns Hopkins University says this technology is super helpful for managing diabetes.
For patients and the families of people with type 1 diabetes, I mean, it's been, you know, truly revolutionary.
Helping people avoid dangerously low blood sugar. But last year, the FDA approved the first over-the-counter versions of continuous glucose monitors for people without diabetes. The idea is that they may help people lose weight and improve their overall health. Sarah Berry is a nutritionist at King's College London and chief scientist at the company Zoe, which distributes the monitors. She says everyone has blood sugar spikes when they eat carbohydrates.
Peaks and troughs in glucose is a normal physiological response to consuming carbohydrates.
But problems can arise when these surges are too big for too long.
Having really high levels over a long period of time can increase your risk of some chronic diseases.
Like heart disease, obesity, and type 2 diabetes. So in theory, a continuous glucose monitor could help people lower their blood sugar levels and reduce their risk for these problems. Several studies have tested that theory. Colin Popp, a nutritionist at New York University, helped to lead one of them. That study found that on average, the glucose monitors did not help people lower their blood sugar very much at all.
We actually found no real effect. We didn't find any significant results.
And the monitoring didn't help people lose weight any better than simply following a traditional low-fat diet. But Popp says those negative findings were the average outcome and not the full story.
Some people did really well. We had individuals coming back to us being like, you changed my life. I lost 30 pounds. I feel great.
While others in the study gained weight. So scientists are now trying to figure out who benefits from this technology. Karen Kennedy, a private nutritionist, says the devices help some people make a big discovery about themselves. They're extremely sensitive to carbohydrates, even the healthy ones.
Brown rice, quinoa, beans, grains, every time they eat it, their blood sugar goes too high, and it's consistently that way.
Then, if they eat fewer carbohydrates,
their blood sugar comes down dramatically, they feel better, they lose visceral fat.
And she says, when you wear the glucose monitor, you log what you eat. This helps people be more aware of how different foods impact their blood sugar.
They're like, oh, when I eat this, my blood sugar goes up, and if I don't, it doesn't. And as soon as they change it, they're like, oh, that's an improvement.
And that improvement motivates some people to eat better. Each device lasts about 2 weeks and costs about $50. But if you're thinking of buying one, NYU's Colin Popp warns that the data can often be confusing for a lot of people.
If you give someone a bunch of data and they don't know what to do with it, what's the point?
So he says there needs to be more guidance and education about this new technology. For NPR News, I'm Michaeline Duclef.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Summer vacations and holidays can be happy times for families, but for divorce lawyers, they often signal that unhappy couples are about to call it quits. NPR's Vanessa Romo explains why divorce is a seasonal business.
Kirk Stange keeps a close eye on the calendar, and right now, he's enjoying the summer break. Stange is a family law attorney with 25 years in the business. Over that time, he's noticed that divorce filings hit two peaks per year.
Our business really picks up in the springtime, and then it tends to pick up August, September-ish.
Stange's firm has 27 offices across 9 states, and he says he's been keeping meticulous records on the influx of new clients for the last decade. He says he can see a drop of about 50% in divorce filings during the slower periods.
We could spend money advertising and try to do things, but it just doesn't work.
Another divorce lawyer, Rayford Dalton Palmer, says his firm's data backs up what Stange has found.
Most divorcing people on average, certainly in our experience, are people with children. But even if they don't have children, they have family events going on around the holidays and in the spring.
It's only until after the Christmas or Hanukkah festivities or after the graduations and family summer vacations that unhappy married couples finally act, he says, usually before the new school year begins.
It continues kind of like a wave based on people's life events.
It's not just lawyers who've picked up on the cycles. A 2016 study from the University of Washington that analyzed divorce filing data across the state found that they consistently peaked in March and August. The study's author says that's because couples might be caught in a cycle of optimism that's tied to domestic rituals. So as thoughts of Santa or the Easter Bunny take over, so too do feelings of anticipation and new beginnings. And that keeps people hanging on for just a little bit longer until they move ahead with the divorce. Carol Lee Roberts thinks the timing of when couples decide to divorce is more complicated than that.
Some states have specific waiting periods before you can even serve the other party. Other states don't have those type of rules.
Roberts is president of the Institute for Divorce Financial Analysts. She notes research showing 37% of married people have been thinking about divorce for 2 years or more. The divorce rate has dropped nationwide, but Roberts says another important pattern that's emerged is the rise in what are called gray divorces.
The divorce rate for people age 50 or above has doubled since 1990. It has tripled for people over age 60 in the same period.
And increasingly, she said, it's women who are filing to end their marriages, largely because they're making more money now than they have in the past. Vanessa Romo, NPR News.
Climate change is pushing more wildfires into cities and suburbs that really aren't used to them. But reducing wildfire risk is possible. As part of NPR's Climate Solutions Week, Colorado Public Radio's Ishan Takor takes us to a neighborhood that did just that.
In 2021, the Marshall Fire ripped through Ann Brennan's neighborhood in Louisville, Colorado. It's near Boulder. Afterwards, she and her neighbors had to make a decision, stay and rebuild or leave.
It was a very tough, I think we all wrestled with that choice.
At first, she wasn't sure, but as more neighbors returned, she said it built some momentum.
You know, well, if y'all are coming back, and if y'all are coming back, and if y'all are coming back, then...
Rebuilding after the fire brought their entire neighborhood closer. Lisa Hughes has lived next to Brennan for decades.
I didn't know that many of the other neighbors in the neighborhood prior to the fire, but now I do.
The Marshall Fire was unusual. It started in grassland, but spread really fast, reaching deep into the suburbs where people had never really worried about wildfire. Jennifer Balch is a fire expert at the University of Colorado Boulder.
To see a Chuck E. Cheese evacuated and a Costco evacuated, to see a hotel burn down on 36 was a very different wildfire than what I have been used to seeing.
She says fires like that are becoming more likely. Climate change is increasing wildfire risk by changing weather patterns and drying out more places.
We need to stop thinking about fire as a problem that just happens out in the middle of the woods to thinking about our homes as fuels, too.
Everything in our homes is super flammable, says Kamiko Barrett. She works at Headwaters Economics, a research group. She says a few simple fixes can help protect your home. It's called home hardening.
We do know that many of the most effective home hardening risk reduction strategies are also the most affordable.
Ann Brennan took some of those steps when she rebuilt her home in Louisville. Some fixes are as simple as adding mesh under her porch, which also had some side benefits.
The mesh, they work to keep bunnies out from under our deck as well.
Mesh screening keeps embers away from your home. That's an important fix because embers are the main reason homes burn down. They can soar miles ahead of flames and enter your home through attic or basement vents. Small mesh screens or getting wildfire-resistant vents are some of the cheapest ways to help protect your home. Then there's fix number two. Defend the 5 feet closest to your home by removing anything flammable, like trees or wood mulch. Brennan's yard is way more bare than it used to be.
This is a very rocky landscape compared to what we had before. But it, you know, it grows on you.
And fix number three, use less flammable materials. Wood porches and plastic siding burn. Brennan swapped them out for a fire-resistant deck, roof, siding, and metal gutters. But she didn't want to give up everything. She rebuilt a wood pergola.
It's really hard to be perfect. We all still have some sort of point of vulnerability, but it's just a bunch of trade-offs.
That's a key point, says Barrett of Headwaters. Perfect isn't the goal. Hardening is about reducing risk, not eliminating it. And maybe most important is fix number four, get to know your neighbors. Because in the suburbs, your house might be only as safe as the homes next to yours. Brennan and Hughes worked closely with their neighbors. Lisa Hughes says now they feel more prepared for anything.
It's more just about being prepared for disaster in general, right? And by you doing it and your neighbors doing it, you're making your community safer.
Rebuilding after the fire, it was hard. They said there was no roadmap. But if there's another disaster, their neighborhood is much safer than before. For NPR News, I'm Ishan Takor in Louisville, Colorado.
Support for NPR's Climate Solutions Week, Rethinking Home, comes from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone, and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.